in the book of Acts. And so he has had his freedom for a long time now as a Christian, as an apostle. He's been free to go wherever he wanted to, so far as it was the Lord's will. But with this now being taken as a prisoner, we know that he is, of course, going to end up going to Rome and being a prisoner there. But he has been mistreated, as we have discovered. His arrest was a scam, really. He hasn't done anything wrong at all. It was said that he took a Gentile into the forbidden place in the temple, which he did not do. That was all speculation, and the people bought it. The Roman authorities, of course, had to do what they did. You remember Claudius Lysias, of course, was the one in charge of keeping the peace in Jerusalem, and particularly the temple area and all of that. That was very important for the Romans. And so this commotion starts up because of the fabrication of a crime, again, brought against Paul. And so he rescued Paul, basically. The Jews, if you recall, they began to beat him once this got about that he took a Gentile into the forbidden place. And if it wasn't for this Roman official, then Paul probably would have been killed. Their aim was to kill him. But he was rescued. And then in our last study, we saw that he ultimately was able to address the crowd. And he did so in the Hebrew language. And so in doing so, along with the fact that that this Roman authority even allowed him to speak, which was unusual, and that really grabbed the attention of the crowd. And so Paul has their full attention. And we have gone through that. And what Paul said to them, he begins to tell them how he was converted, which was, of course, an amazing story. We've seen it twice now. First, back in Acts chapter 9, as the story was told, Luke reveals it to us. But now in this case, it is Paul who went through it himself, giving the direct details of what happened, to him in the situation. And it's really captivating, just like it is to us. We won't go over that now, but if you're visiting with us, I'm sure that most of you have studied before the conversion of Paul, and we have emphasized how important that conversion is. Not only, of course, for Christianity and the great work that Paul did as an apostle of Christ, but even the record of his conversion has many people have obeyed the gospel on the basis of that conversion. Because when you stop and think about it, Paul was converted for the most part all at once. And we know literally it was about a 3-day period of time. He saw Jesus on the road to Damascus, and then he was led into the city and was there praying, was there for 3 days, and Ananias came to him and exhorted him to arise and be baptized, and he was, and he became a child of God. But it wasn't a long, drawn-out situation. And so people would be amazed. This is the fella. Again, his life before he obeyed the gospel wasn't in the closet. He was climbing up the ladder of Judaism, and people knew him. No doubt some of the very people that he is now addressing would have at least heard about this man. He was an important individual, a Pharisee. So he certainly, what he did and how he persecuted the church, all of that would have been either, they would have had either direct knowledge of it or had heard about it. And now here he is. This same one who persecuted the church almost all at once goes to the opposite side. And he's now on the side of the very people that he was persecuting, the very people that he went to the high priest in the Sanhedrin to get letters so that he could go all the way to Damascus and arrest them. And that's where now all of a sudden he's on their side. And again, it's not a long, drawn out period. Now, I have seen through the years, and so have you, sometimes preachers get off track, and sometimes individuals in Christ get off track and maybe leave the truth and that sort of thing. And a lot of times it's gradual, and you can see it coming. I've known preachers who you can just tell in their terminology, their language changes a little bit. They begin to say things that sound a whole lot like the language of denominationalism, and And all of a sudden, you find that they just start drifting, drifting, drifting. And sooner or later, they end up leaving the faith. And it doesn't always happen. Sometimes people are able to get back on track. But I'm just saying, you see that happen. It's a gradual kind of thing. Not here with Paul. Paul just all of a sudden changes. And that's why people have read the account of Paul all through the years. Some, even atheists, have read the account of Paul's conversion, and there's no real answer to it except for what we read in these accounts in Acts, that he saw the glorified Christ on the road to Damascus. And because of that vision, all at once, he now has a different way of thinking. He now knows this Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ. And so that's why the change is so quick. But if people today think that, if people years after that conversion, hundreds of years after that conversion, people read the story and they realize, how in the world, what would cause a man who basically was a zealot in Judaism change to the other side so quickly? Well, if people today think that, what do you think they were thinking back then in the first century who had heard of Paul, who knew of his situation, and now all of a sudden he's on the other side? That would be amazing to them. And now here is Paul, and he has their attention. He's captivated them because, again, he's speaking in the Hebrew language, and he's even allowed to speak by the Roman official, and he begins to tell the story of his conversion. This explains the change. I saw Jesus of Nazareth. And so he has their full attention until he says one thing. He brings up the dreaded Gentiles. And you can just almost, you know, they're of course not sitting on comfortable pews like you all are, but you can just imagine people, they're just captivated at the edge of their seat and everything, and all of a sudden they hear Gentiles and it snaps them out of it. And now all of a sudden they want Paul dead. Notice as we go forward here in Acts 22, at verse 21 it says, "And he said to me, 'Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles.'" He again is relating his conversion. And verse 22, "Up to this word they listened to him." What word? Gentile. "Up to this word they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and they said, 'Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live.'" They want him dead. And these individuals are zealots themselves. I mean, these Jews have a terrorist-like attitude. I mean, they don't think anyone, that the Gentiles, they just absolutely hated. And they viewed Paul now as a Gentile lover, as a betrayer of their faith, of Judaism. And the fact that he used to be a Pharisee and used to promote the cause of Judaism, that even raised the hatred in the minds of many Jews who came into contact with Paul. He's a betrayer. He's a traitor. And so they want him dead. They want him, if they could, they'd want him killed on the spot. And as we found earlier, they would have killed him themselves if Lysias didn't come in and interrupt that situation. But they say, again, away from the earth. At verse 23, "And as they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, the tribune ordered him to be brought into the barracks." Now, let's not forget what Lysias is trying to accomplish here. He's the Roman who's in charge of the peace, and all of that has been interrupted. There's a mob now in a riot-like situation, and it was very important for the Romans to keep the Jews and any nation that had influence under control within the empire. And the Jews had a reputation. They could stir things up and they could make trouble. And so the Romans basically, even though they could have squashed the Jews, and ultimately not too many years from this, of course, AD 70 is when the Jewish nation was, of course, defeated when they rebelled and all of that. That's not too far from where we are now. But they could cause a lot of trouble. And so the Romans, in a lot of ways, they tried to appease the Jews. And so it was important for Claudius Lysias to get this situation now under control. And he's doing everything he can to do that. He rescues Paul. He lets Paul address the people. But it hasn't turned out the way he wanted. And he wants some answers. He doesn't even know why this mess started in the first place. And so he wants some answers. And that's in part why he let Paul address the people. But it turns into this situation where they're right back out of control again, shouting and throwing off their cloaks. And so he orders Paul back into the barracks, saying that he should be examined by flogging. That seems a little severe, doesn't it, for this situation? But he's just, you know, of course, in a normal situation, Paul, or whoever it would have been, we know who Paul is and we know his situation in this ordeal. But if you're the commander, if you're the one in charge, you really couldn't count on this prisoner telling the truth. He would have a reason, the authority would think, to hold things back. So now Lysias is thinking, the only way I'm going to get to the bottom of all this is if this one who is being attacked tells me. So we need to get the information from him. And so he orders him to be flogged. And this is not the Jewish flogging. 30 stripes save one. This is the Roman flogging, which was a lot more severe, which, as we've described before, took place with a whip that had little pieces of bone or stone that were in the end of the whip and would almost always rip the skin right off your back. Sometimes take out eyes. And 7 out of 10 people, we're told, died under a flogging. Now, Paul's really not in danger of that. Because with the Roman, it was completely under the discretion of the authority as to how far he allowed the flogging to go. And Romans were without mercy a lot of times. And that's why a lot of people would die under a flogging. But Lysias isn't trying to kill Paul. He's just even as it's stated here in verse 22, that he wants him to be examined. Verse 24, he just wants Paul to be examined by the flogging. He's trying to get information from Paul. He's probably hoping that Paul, once he's strapped up, and the way it would go is they'd put you in a semi-bent position tied to a pole when you're very exposed, and then the whipping would begin. He's probably hoping Paul, once they bind him up, that he'll just get to talking and he'll spill what he thinks he knows. And so Paul's really not in danger of the authority allowing this to go on to the point where he dies under the flogging. A lot of people, if they didn't die, they were crippled because of how barbaric it was. But Paul's not in much danger of that. He just wants to get the information from him. So he orders him to be examined by this flogging. But it's nothing less than torture is what this is. He did it to find out why they were shouting against him like this. But when they stretched him out for the whips, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, "Is it lawful for you to flog a man who is a Roman citizen and uncondemned?" Now, this is the second time Paul brought this up, isn't it? The first time, you remember, in Acts chapter 16 with regard to his situation in Philippi. On that occasion, his life really wasn't in danger. In fact, he had already been ordered to be let go along with Silas. And that situation was that they had brought shame upon Paul and Silas publicly. And now, for whatever reason, we're not told in the text why all of a sudden the Jewish authorities had the Romans had a change of heart with this thing. But now they wanted to kind of just secret, just let him go. And Paul wasn't having that. And so he brought up the fact that he was a Roman citizen and caused the one in charge to come to him. But now his life again. On the outskirts, he's facing a situation that's very dangerous here. When you're talking about a flogging, even though, as I said a moment ago, Lysias is probably not trying to kill Paul or anything like that. In fact, we know he's not. But whenever you're talking about someone being whipped with the kind of instrument that we just described, anything could happen. And, you know, after it could possibly, after three or four whips, kill somebody. And so, you know, it is a dangerous situation with regard to Paul. And so, but he lets them know that he's a Roman citizen, again, for the second time, and it absolutely startles the ones in charge. Because as we said before in Acts chapter 16, they know the seriousness of this. You cannot flog a Roman citizen who is uncondemned. Under certain situations, a Roman citizen might be scourged, but he had to be condemned in a court of law. He had to go through the process and all of that. It could not be an unlawful kind of thing like this is. And everybody knows Paul has he hasn't been condemned in a court of law or anything like this. And so he's a Roman citizen, uncondemned. And that would startle the centurions, that everyone involved. They would know now they're in trouble. Because technically now, if they would have flogged him, now they would be up for a flogging themselves. Even Claudius Lysias would be up to be scourged if they had done that. And so they stop that immediately, and they go and they tell the tribune about it. At verse 28 it says, "And when the centurion heard this, he went to the tribune and said to him, 'What are you about to do? For this man is a Roman citizen.'" So the tribune came and he said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" And he said, "Yes." And the tribune answered, "I bought this citizenship for a large sum." And again, we don't have a lot of background on that. The fact that this man's name is Claudius Lysias, which isn't really a Roman name, tells you that, probably give you a clue that he bought his citizenship. And sometimes this Roman citizenship would be up for sale, particularly in the days of Claudius. When he was emperor, his wife was having an affair with the censor of the town, and they were selling Roman citizenship for money. And, you know, that would be, people would pay big money for that. It was huge in the Roman Empire to be a Roman citizen. It came with all kinds of advantages. And so people were paying big money. Now, whether this is the case, some people think that's why this man's name is Claudius Lysias, because it was during the reign of Claudius that he got his citizenship. We can't be sure about that, but what we can be sure about is what he stated. He bought his citizenship for a great sum. It cost a lot of money. But what about Paul? How did he get his citizenship? Paul responds by saying, "But I'm a citizen by birth." So that makes his more legitimate. And how in the world Paul became a Roman citizen, or his father rather, we don't know. But Paul was either, this makes Paul at the very least a second generation Roman citizen, because he was a Roman citizen by birth. It could have been his father performed some great deed for the Roman state and was awarded citizenship, or maybe even his grandfather. We don't know. But he was at least a second generation Roman citizen. And so that made his citizenship even more legitimate. And you could just picture Paul saying this. You know, this guy's like, "Well, you know, I had to buy my citizenship." And Paul's saying, "Well, I was born a Roman citizen, buddy." he probably didn't say that, but you can see how this is significant. And right away, this man who is important and who really has Paul's fate in his hands, he's the one in charge and has been since the scene began. Now all of a sudden, you could see him in his own mind thinking, you know, this is an important fella. He was already impressed with Paul, remember? Just because he spoke in Greek, he spoke in the Hebrew language, all of that. He heard the background of Paul, sat at the feet of Gamaliel, all of that. Paul is an impressive guy. There's no doubt. And now to add upon all of that, he's a Roman citizen, and not just one who bought it, but he was born such. So he came from an important family. And so all of that is very significant. So those who were about to examine him withdrew from him immediately. And the tribune also was afraid, for he realized that Paul was a Roman citizen and that he had bound him. And there was no chance of Paul lying about this thing, by the way. You might wonder as you read this, why do they just take his word for it? You know, you would think if people were so easily convinced, just about anybody who was in trouble could just cry, I'm a Roman citizen. And no, because to do that was a capital punishment, a capital crime. If you claimed to be a Roman citizen and weren't, that meant death. That was the penalty for that. That's how important being a Roman citizen was. You don't pretend to be a Roman citizen if you weren't. And it would be easily discovered. If somebody was lying about that, it would take very little time to find that out. So nobody lied about that. Somebody probably did at some point. But generally speaking, when someone said, I'm a Roman citizen, everybody knew the person was telling the truth. And you can tell by this narrative before us, they didn't even begin to doubt it. Once Paul said it, they knew he was telling the truth. And so they were afraid. And this tribune, he's the one ultimately who's responsible for binding him up and for him to be examined by a flogging. So he is afraid. But on the next day, verse 30 says, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief priest and all of the council to meet, and he brought Paul down and set him before them. So, again, you see what's going on. Lysias, he just wants to get to the bottom of all this. He's tried three different ways now to get to the truth. I just want to know what's causing all of this commotion in my city. I have to get a hold of this. And everything he tries seems to fail. And so now he tries. He's allowed Paul to address the people. That didn't work. He threatens to flog Paul. That hasn't worked. So now he arranges for Paul to appear before the Sanhedrin, for them to gather themselves together, and surely the Sanhedrin would know why this man is being charged with crimes, and why everyone is shouting, why everyone is so upset about the situation. So that's his next attempt, to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin. So they gather themselves together, and Paul has the opportunity to address them. Now, we get into chapter 23, and the chapter break is unfortunate. It really, you know, you just continue. Of course, man put that in there, and we just continue on. It says again at verse 30 that they brought Paul down and set him before them, and looking intently at the council, Paul said, brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. Now, that's an important statement for a lot of reasons. The first one that comes to mind, and 100 sermons have been preached on it, is that you really can't just rely on your conscience, can you? That you can be sincere and do something in all good conscience, and yet that something, whatever it is, could be dead wrong. And that certainly is the case with Paul. Do you believe Paul when he said, I've lived in all good conscience? Do you think he's telling the truth? A man who was guilty of murdering Christians, really? A man who was willing to go all the way to Damascus and bring not only men, but you remember the text said men and women. That was unusual. Who did all of that? He lived in all good conscience? How could he live in good conscience treating Christians like that? He thought he was doing it for God. He believed sincerely that this is what God wants. Up until the time he saw Jesus on the road to Damascus, he believed with all his heart he was an imposter. That he had died, they had gotten rid of him, and now these Christians are talking about Jesus and preaching in his name and all of this, and he wanted to put an end to it. He really thought he was an instrument being used by God. He believed it with every fiber of his being. There's no doubt about that. And yet he was wrong, wasn't he? How many people in religious world today are very sincere? I would suggest to you the majority of people. I've said it before. I think we err when we attribute people being insincere, or think for a minute that somehow we're more sincere than other people who might be in error. It's never a matter, almost never, a matter of sincerity. Now, there's some fakes and frauds out there, of course. When you talk about the TV evangelist and those kind of people, there's a lot of fakery going on. I understand all of that. But the common person sitting on a pew in a church building of a denominational church is every bit as sincere as you are. They believe that they're doing what is right. It's true with other religions. Do you think these Muslims who would attach a bomb to them and go and commit suicide, blowing up other people and themselves, you don't think that they're sincere in what they're doing? They believe they're pleasing Allah, that they're pleasing their God, and that after they're blown into pieces that they'll be before 1,000 virgins or whatever the doctrine is. They believe that. They're absolutely convinced about that. But they're wrong. And so sincerity then, and there's an important lesson. There's an important lesson there for people who are in denomination. Just because you think you're right, that doesn't mean you are. There's a way that seems right, but the end thereof is death. Proverbs 14:12 and other passages teach the same thing. And so we understand then sincerity is not enough. Now, is the conscience important at all? Yes, yes. You don't want to go around violating your conscience. In fact, Romans chapter 14, you remember in Paul talking about eating meat, he emphasizes the fact that there's nothing wrong with eating meat unless what? Unless you think it is. That's right. If you can't do it of faith, Paul says. And what he is saying there, if it violates your conscience to eat meat, don't eat meat. And if you go ahead and eat the meat, even though there's a part of you that thinks it displeases God, you sin against God. Because you're doing something you think God may not like, but you do it anyway. And so we have to follow our conscience up to a certain extent. But the conscience that is reliable is only the conscience that is trained and taught by the Word of God. That's why it always gets back to the Word of God. And now, so if your conscience is properly trained, then it could be a good guide, and you ought not to violate it. But just don't think just because something feels good that it's necessarily right. That's the thing. With Paul, he lived in all good conscience, but he was dead wrong. When he was persecuting the church, he was persecuting Christ. That's what Jesus accused him of course, on the road to Damascus. And so we have to be careful about all of that. But he says to them, and calls them brothers. Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up until this day. Now, verse 2, it says, and the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Now, for some reason, and this is real, Ananias is upset. It's kind of hard to figure out exactly why he got so mad at what Paul just said. And a lot of people believe it was because Ananias himself, we know this for a fact, the history of it, that he was an unscrupulous man. He was a Sadducee, haughty, full of pride and lived in many ways an immoral life. His end it wasn't pretty itself. In 66 A.D., the Jews turned on this Ananias and assassinated him because they thought he was taking sides with the Romans. So he wasn't a beloved figure at all. And his character wasn't good. And some people think, just because when Paul brings up this idea of living in all good conscience, that he takes that as a personal attack, that he's implying that Ananias was not. And I don't know if any of that is true. But something got under his skin. I mean, all Paul said is, I've lived all my life in good conscience, and he tells the one standing by, hit him for that. And so... He clearly, obviously, they have hostility against Paul, but that was a strange reaction. And Paul, in verse 3, he said, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law, you order me to be struck? And we don't know what scripture Paul is referring here to. Most believe that he is referring to Leviticus 19, verse 15. And if you read that, it talks about doing no injustice in court. And this is a makeshift court situation. But clearly, nobody doubts that what Paul said is true, that it was at the very least a violation of the spirit of the law for one sitting in authority to order such a thing in this circumstance. And so he was being, Ananias was a big hypocrite, is what he was. He's claiming to be a judge. A part of all of this is claiming that Paul somehow is violating the law and that sort of thing, and yet he willingly orders them to do something that would be a violation of the law. So Paul calls him on it. And this is pretty harsh. You whitewashed wall. Again, that simply means you hypocrite. They would paint things white that were unclean, graves and that sort of thing. But while they would whitewash it, you still have the dirt, the filth underneath. So when you apply that to a human being, what does it mean? Oh, you look clean on the outside, but morally you're filthy. And saying that to a high priest, that's pretty tough language that Paul uses. Is Paul mad here? Huh? Yeah, he's lost his temper, is what has happened here, just quickly here. You know, you can say some things that are pretty stern, and Paul, we have record of Paul doing that. When he's completely in control, he's not upset at all. He's just stating facts. Here, he's mad. He gets mad at this hypocrite, and he calls him on it. And the people standing by, they, of course, speak out about that. It says, and now when Paul, verse 4 says, those who stood by said, would you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, I did not know, brothers, that he was a high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. And so Paul, you know, in a humble fashion, admits that perhaps he should not have said what he did. At least that's what a lot of people, some people think he's being sarcastic. I did not know you were a priest, meaning you sure don't act like a high priest. And some people believe that's what it is. And some people, how in the world could Paul not know Ananias was the high priest? Well, remember, Paul's been out of that situation for 20 years now. And so this individual took office after Paul had switched sides, so to speak. So it's very likely that Paul didn't know who he was. Now, if he was all dressed up like the high priest often would be, then Paul was being sarcastic here. But again, there's no evidence. This all has happened very quickly. This is not a normal meeting when you would go to the appropriate place and stand before the Sanhedrin. Lysias has called them together in a makeshift kind of situation. So it's very possible he didn't have on his regular high priest attire and all of that. And Paul does show some humility here, quotes scripture saying perhaps he should not have said what he did. But one thing Paul sees here is this is a mess. I mean, one way or another, the high priest is out of control. The people who are following the high priest under his authority, they're out of control. He has zero chance of these people listening. And so Paul is smart. He knows the Sanhedrin. Some people believe he used to be a part of it. But he knows the Sanhedrin. He knows the makeup of the Sanhedrin. Who makes up the Sanhedrin? Who? And who else? Sadducees and Pharisees. Now, the Sadducees probably had most of the clout, but the Pharisees probably had most of the numbers and of the Sanhedrin. Most people believe there were more Pharisees on the Sanhedrin than Sadducees, but the Sadducees were the rich, wealthy, the ones who had influence, and of course the high priest was always a Sadducee. But Paul knows the makeup of this high council. And so he knows he's in trouble. He knows he's lost the audience. He knows he doesn't have a chance of really giving a defense. They haven't even allowed him to go forward with a defense. And so verse 6 says, when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, brethren, I am a Pharisee. Now this is interesting. A son of a Pharisee. And we're just learning that. We didn't know that. Paul not only was a Pharisee, we always go to Philippians 3 and talk about Paul being a Pharisee and a Hebrew of Hebrews and all of that. His father was a Pharisee. That's more interesting stuff about Paul and his background. And but he's a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. You think Paul knew that would have an impact on this audience? He knew exactly the position of the Sadducees. They didn't believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in life after death. They didn't believe in eternal soul in any of that. And Paul knew that. So he obviously is trying to align himself with the Pharisees, and he used to be one, because he's trying to turn them against each other. And it's exactly what happened. And he knew it would happen. He knew this would work. So he cried out. He says it's in respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. And when he said this, the dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. And then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes and the Pharisees partly stood up and contended sharply, "We find nothing wrong in this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him?" What a change, just like that. Can you see as we read through these narratives how insincere all of these folks are? They're all a bunch of hypocrites. And none of them care. The least, the last thing on their mind is getting to truth. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, none of them are very honest. And here are the Pharisees who are absolutely against Paul. And make no mistake about it, they hate him. They were involved in the mob that was beating Paul and wanted to beat him to death if the official didn't step in. They hate Paul. And now all of a sudden, because they're now in real life outside of Paul, the feud that was constantly raging on a daily basis was between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. So when this comes up, immediately, oh, he might be innocent. Maybe he hadn't done anything wrong. And it just, again, theological hypocrisy on the part of these Pharisees. They're willing to give in, even though they don't like Paul at all. They're willing to side with him because they hate the Sadducees as well. So this works, and they're divided, and Paul's able to get out of this situation. As we read further, we find that there is a commotion, and now Lysias has to step back in and rescue Paul from this commotion that he kind of stirred up. But he does, and we'll see what happens there in our next class. I'll be gone next week, and then the Wednesday after that, we'll pick up right here in Acts 23. Appreciate your attention.